Okay, it is already recording, and yeah, I think it's time to start with the our seminar. I'll start introducing Caroline, but before, like also, like Caroline told me that if you have questions, please you feel free to ask, like either like in the chat or just like raise your voice and ask a question, and either is fine, and Caroline will be happy to respond. And now, like, let me introduce Caroline. So this is like the last session of the Oxford Computational Statistics and Machine Learning Seminar in this season. And we have Caroline Uhler from MIT, who is going to speak about causality and autoencoders in the light of drug repurposing for COVID-19. And Caroline is currently the Henry and Grace Doherty Associate Professor in Electrical Engineering and Computer Science and Institute for Data Systems and Society at MIT. She holds many degrees in math and biology from the University of Zurich and a PhD in statistics from UC Berkeley. Before joining MIT, she was a postdoc at the Simons Institute at UC Berkeley, at the University of Minnesota and ETH Zurich. She was also an assistant professor at AST Austria. Caroline is a member, an elected member of the International Statistical Institute, and she won a Simon Investigator Award, a Sloan Research Fellowship, among many others. And the reason for why we have Caroline here is because she does very exciting research at the intersection of machine learning, computer science, and computational biology. In particular on causal inference, generative modeling, and applications to genomics. So Caroline, please feel free to give your talk.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very excited to be here. So we've been working, as Gonzalo just said, you know, a lot on causality in recent years. And then once, you know, COVID-19 started, many people in the lab were wondering how we could use the kind of research that we have been doing towards this problem. And so that's when we started working on drug repurposing, which is the kind of problem that I'm going to be presenting here. And in particular, I'm going to talk about the mathematics, the statistics, the machine learning questions that have arisen just due to these questions, these biological or medical kinds of questions, and really go more into the statistics and machine learning topics that have been important for actually coming up with the kind of method that we have then applied here. So let me start right off with the problem of drug repurposing, in particular in this setting, in the context of COVID-19, but this is of course more generally a problem that could be applied to also many other diseases as well. So how does drug development work, and in particular how does drug repurposing work? So you know, drug repurposing is particularly important when you have diseases where, you know, you don't want to or have time to go through all of the different trials, because these trials, of course, often fail and they take really, really long. And so drug repurposing means that you're using drugs that have already been FDA approved and try to find which ones might also be effective in a new disease context. This can then speed up kinds of trials, because you don't have to go through the safety trials anymore. You can just directly go to the efficacy trials and try to see whether this new drug also, or this old drug also works in this new disease context. So how do drugs work generally? Well, drugs usually target a particular protein and then try to make this protein ineffective. And through that, what you want to do is you want to find drugs that can then push the system back to the normal state. Okay, so now if we're thinking about it, and in particular, you know, often we think about it in these network, and we will see networks also coming up towards the end of the talk. So, you know, people have used a lot of these undirected graphs in order to come up with drugs that could and to come up with the right targets for these drugs. So in particular, you know, if you have here, say, in red and in blue are these nodes that are, and maybe these are now genes or proteins, whatever you're looking at. And these are the nodes that in the disease context are differentially expressed as compared to the normal context. Then, you know, one of the standard approaches is to define targets that are connected or very central to many nodes that are differentially expressed in the disease context. Now, of course, you know, if you come already from a little bit of a causality background, and also otherwise, you know, it is clear that if your true network, you know, that in general in biology, right, there are, that these are all directed relationships where you have like a certain protein or a certain transcription factor turning on another gene, etc. And so if your true network looks something like this directed graph here, then of course, if you're targeting this node here in the middle, well, then although it is connected to all these differentially expressed genes, these genes are not going to change, right? These red and blue genes, there is no hope of actually moving the system back to the normal state. So the directions matter a lot, right? And so causal relationships will actually matter a lot. You cannot just do this in down-directed graph. So, you know, in particular, if the graph looks something like this, then maybe this is a good target, right? Because you at least have a chance of changing all these, you know, nodes that are differentially expressed in a disease in the right way by actually targeting this particular node here. Okay, so directions really matter. And so this is one way where actually causality comes in. And I'll only talk short about this. So we have done a lot of research in terms of actually learning these directed graphs or these causal graphs from data on the nodes without knowing the directions. And so this will be just a little bit of the talk all the way at the end. I want to talk about something different that is another problem that also appears in these drug repurposing studies. And that's the following. So, you know, like if we're thinking now of SARS-CoV-2, then SARS-CoV-2 in particular has an effect on these lung epithelial cells. Okay. So now what are the data sets? So often, of course, drug identifying new drugs is still done very much experimentally, although there are more and more computational approaches. And in fact, also successful drugs that have been, you know, gone through all of the trials using just that were identified using computational methods. And so what are the data sets that one can use if one's actually trying to use computational methods? So there are these really large scale drug screens, and I'm going to show some of them, or one of them, in fact, on one of the next slides, where you have many, many drugs. And I'm going to concentrate on these FDA approved ones because we're thinking about drug repurposing. But in fact, in these drug screens, you also have many non-FDA approved drugs. You also have all kinds of knockouts, et cetera. So many, many different kinds of interventions on the system that have been applied to some cell types. Now, this particular screen that I'm going to look at is a cancer screen. So the cell types that these drugs were applied to are all different kinds of cancer cell lines. Now, the problem is, of course, that, you know, now what we want to do is be able to identify drugs that will work in this new context, which is not cancer, right? And that will, so we want to be able to predict the effect of these drugs on SARS-CoV-2 infected lung epithelial cells. Okay, these are cells that are not in this drug screen. So every time a new disease comes up, right, you would otherwise have to redo the whole drug screen. And that's, of course, infeasible to do, right? So what you really need to be able to do is somehow to transfer these causal effects. So, you know the effect of all these drugs or these interventions on some cell lines where they were measured. Now, can you from here predict what the effect of these drugs will be on a different cell line? Okay, on a cell line where you know how it looks like in the normal state, right? But you have not seen any of these drugs applied to it. And so you would like to be able to transfer it to that cell. So that's the kind, and this is again a causal actually question, right? Because a drug or, you know, any knockout, et cetera, is an intervention in the system. Okay, so I have an intervention in the system, and now I want to be able to predict what this intervention in the system will do in a different setting, or in a different, we call this environment. Okay, so one cell type is one environment, and you know, another cell type is another environment. These same questions appear a lot in policy kinds of questions, where you know the effect of a particular policy in a city, which would there be the environment, and you want to predict what the effect of this policy will be in another city. So this is known as the causal transportability problem. So it's again a causal problem, just because it is an intervention. And so that's the main question that I want to talk about. So that's this question here. Is like, how can you transport the effect of a drug from one environment, say here a red cell type, to a blue cell type? Okay, so to predict what this intervention will do in actually this blue cell type. The other question I talked about before is, you know, how can you even learn these underlying, these regulatory networks, right? And, you know, this will actually come up, and we have worked a lot on this problem as well, and this will just come up in the end where we actually want to validate some of the kinds of relationships and causal relationships that we're finding. Okay, but I'll mainly talk about this causal transportability problem here. If you know the effect of different kinds of drugs on some cell types, And now you would like to predict what the effect of these drugs is in the cell type that you actually care about, which in this case is SARS-CoV-2 infected lung epithelial cells, where you have not measured any of the drugs yet. And please, again, as Gonzalo just said, just interrupt me whenever you have questions. Okay, so if you come from machine learning, then there's probably one very straightforward approach that you may want to try. And in fact, I know that here in the UK, I have talked quite a bit to AstraZeneca. I know that they have tried this. So this is certainly something like very, very standard. And you know, it has not worked for them. And I'll show you why it might not have worked so well for them and how one could maybe get around it. So if you come from machine learning land, this is probably kind of an approach that you might say like, well, we should probably at least try, right? So we all know this from, and you know, often it's used using GANs. I'm going to use autoencoders in this whole talk and also just because we actually have some theory for it. So I'm sure you're all familiar with autoencoders. So we have here this encoder in neural network that maps you from some space. This can be gene expression, it can be images. To this latent space and then the decoder, which maps you back. And we're going to learn this map just by trying to minimize reconstruction error. Now, you know, there are all these like really nice applications that are usually done with GANs, and I'm sure you've seen them where you, you know, want to translate an image that you have taken in summer to winter, or you have like some people and you want to add smiles to them, right? So here you have some people that you've taken, some are smiling and some are also neutral face. And then maybe here, you know, this vector here corresponds to this person here adding a smile to her, right? And now here you have a new person and you would like to know how does this person look like with a smile? You have never taken this picture. Well, maybe what will work is actually taking this vector here that corresponds to adding a smile in a different person and just moving it up to this one person here. And then decoding this point back into image land. And in fact, in this case, you know, out would come a person with a smile. Now, the question, of course, is can something like this also work when you have drugs, right? So, you know, here how you should think of it is like we have different kinds of cell types, like this blue here, this pink one, another blue, another purple one. For some of them, you get to observe what the effect is of a particular drug. And now, you know, you want to predict the effect of this drug on a new cell type. In this case, this would be, you know, these would be the cancer cell lines where we've seen the drugs on. This would be the SARS-CoV-2 infected lung epithelial cell. And we would like to be able to predict the effect of this drug. Well, maybe, you know, in the latent space, I could just take the effect of this drug and then move it over to my new cell type and then just decode it back out into the latent space and out would come the effect, the effect of what this drug will have on the SARS-CoV-2 infected cell line. Okay, so this has actually worked in this particular paper here, worked actually quite well just for a few cell types and a few drugs. And so the question is, of course, is this a general phenomenon? And as I've already told you, AstraZeneca has tried this and, you know, this in general does not work. In fact, you should also not expect it to work. I mean, there is work by Barenboim and co-authors, they have done, and Pearl, et cetera. There is a long route of work, and I've already told you this is known as causal transportability. And Barenboim and Pearl, they actually have really nice work showing that, you know, necessary and sufficient conditions for when causal transportability works. Now, their work, and these are quite stringent conditions. Now, the problem is that their work doesn't really tell us when it will work in this setting here, because they always assume that you know the underlying causal graph. So if I draw something, right, they assume, so they assume that, you know, so you have some causal graph below it, and they assume even more that you know the nodes on which the intervention happens, and even more that you know the nodes which are the ones that change, that are the ones that are important in order to change environment. So say, you know, this is the one that differentiates LA from, you know, I don't know, Boston, right? If you want to do a transfer of a policy from one city to another. So that's another knowledge that you have. So you know where the interventions happen and where the nodes are that change the environment. So make one cell type into another cell type. Then based on this graph, they have necessary and sufficient conditions that tell you whether, you know, the effect of this particular intervention can be transferred to this new city or to this new cell type. Now, you see, we don't have this information, right? I mean, we don't know these underlying regulatory networks. We certainly don't know for the drugs in general, like all the nodes that they have an effect on. And we also don't know the nodes that make a difference between different cell types. But you know, what is really nice is that they do have necessary and sufficient conditions. So you should certainly not expect it to work always. So that's maybe the takeaway from here. So the question is, when does it work and why does it work sometimes? And so let's actually look at the large data set where we'll actually be analyzing this. So this is this large data set that I mentioned that I encourage many of you to look at. I think it has been really, really fun working with this data set. If you care about, you know, questions like this about transfer and about interventions and trying to predict the effect of interventions. So this is publicly available. It's at the Broad. It's a CMAP data set. It has 1.2 million samples where every sample is a 1,000 dimensional vector of gene expression. So here for just some genes, well-selected genes. And then you have here thousands of different perturbations. Okay, so these are these, you know, we'll only look at these FDA approved drugs, but there are many other perturbations that were applied to it. And as I said, they were applied to different cancer cell lines, so around 70 different cancer cell lines. And what you see here is every dot here means that you have data. So that's this 1,000 dimensional vector. But of course, you know, you cannot do all of these experiments, right? So there is a whole lot of white space out here, meaning that these kinds of combinations were not measured. But, you know, you already have a huge amount of data here on which you can then test whether, you know, your method for trying to predict the effect, you just leave out some validation set, right, of whether your method of trying to predict the effect of a perturbation, actually how well you're able to be to predict the effect of a perturbation that was not seen in the data. Okay, so this is the data set that we're going to use in order to actually check, you know, how well that such an autoencoder approach would work. Okay. So, you know,
like in this data, like how are the perturbations measured, or the effect of the perturbations measured? Like,
perfect. Yeah. So this is here. So it's the expression of these 1,000 genes that were measured. So that's why every one of these points here is actually it's really a tensor. So every one of these dots is a 1,000 dimensional vector. Okay. So it's quite nice that it's not just a one-dimensional thing that is actually doing. Mm-hmm. So there are other drug screens where it's just measured whether the cell dies or not. But here, actually, you really get to measure this full 1,000-dimensional vector. Yeah. And this is just a UMAP of this data set, how it looks like. So you do see, so here in color are the different cell types. So these 70 ones here that you have. So what you see is that actually, and this is known, so perturbations have a very small effect as compared to the differences between different cell types. Okay, so this in black here, just believe me that these black points here correspond to, you know, the orange cell type here, but the different drugs applied to it. So you see, it's actually quite, so it's actually a very good baseline is just to predict the effect of a perturbation being the mean of that cell type. It is quite difficult to have methods that do better than that. Okay, so this is always, so that's how you should think of like how this data set actually works. Okay, so let's look a little bit about how these autoencoder methods work. And here is something, and this is what where I'll go a little bit into theory and actually, you know, so it might look a little bit strange now at the beginning, but you know, your standard autoencoders, right? You go from, in this case, we have a 1,000 dimensional space, right? These 1,000 dimensional vectors that we're measuring. Usually you use your autoencoders in order to get a lower dimensional representation of the data, and then you train it back to your original space, this 911 or 1,000 dimensional space. Now, and we'll see that that doesn't work so well. And, you know, many people have seen in pharma industry that this doesn't work so well. Now, what we'll be proposing to do is something maybe that looks very crazy at the moment, because, you know, autoencoders are usually used for dimension reduction. What we're going to do is, you know, not use it for dimension reduction, but we're actually going to go into a latent space that is higher dimensional than the original space. Okay, so start off here with your 1,000 dimensional vector, embed it into a higher dimensional latent space and go back to your original space. Now, so why is this unintuitive? Well, because we have so many parameters that we could just learn the identity map, right? So here I could actually just learn the identity map. What I want to show you, and I'll give you also theory, why we even tried doing something crazy like this, is that when you train such an autoencoder, you're not going to learn the identity map. And I will tell you a bit about what kinds of maps you're actually going to be learning. Okay, so but that's the interesting thing that you actually what you're going to learn is actually something useful, it seems like. And in terms of intuition, I think maybe intuitively kind of makes sense. So, you know, if you want to, so in some sense, what you want to do is you want to make effects more linear, right? So that they're more aligned in the latent space. So you want to make effects more linear. So if you're going into a lower dimensional space, well, your effects will definitely have to become more nonlinear, more crumbled up than what they were before. So if you're adding up, if you're adding more dimensions, that's hopefully allowing you to actually make things more aligned than what they were before. At least intuitively, that makes sense. But of course, it depends on what is the map that is learned by the author. Okay. And so just to show you that something like this is actually happening, we can just check that, right? We can just check it on these data sets here. You just leave out some and you try to predict the effect, or you leave out some. So what you're actually going to do is, you know, so it will only work if the effect of a drug, if you look at different cell types where this particular drug was measured, it only works if the two drugs are aligned. So what we're just going to measure is the vector between the drug, right, in the latent space, between a drug in one cell type versus the other cell type in the latent space, and the correlation between the drug and in one cell type and the other cell type in the original space. And so here, this is what you see. So this is the original space, the correlation. And then here is, if you go into a lower dimensional latent space, in this case, 100 dimensional latent space, and you see that basically not much changes, right? So this is still the diagonal. You do have a little bit of enrichment up here, which is good, right? This is what you would want to see. Now, what happens if you just do PCA, a PCA embedding? Now, well, what happens with PCA? In fact, you get quite good enrichment. So you really get very good alignment. But you're getting good alignment by throwing away all of your data, right? So in fact, you can align space by doing align data by throwing away data, right? But then, of course, you don't have any information anymore about the effect of a drug. And in fact, this is what you see here when you're looking at reconstruction. So this is one way of getting really good alignment, is just throwing out most of your data or most of the information in the data and just keeping, you know, some of the direction. So now what you see here is that actually, if you go to this overparameterized latent space, so in this case, you know, higher dimensional latent space than what you started off with, what you first of all see is that it's not learning the identity map, right? Otherwise, everything would have to be nice on the diagonal. So you do get actually basically the same kind of alignment as what you get with PCA when you're just throwing out all of the information, but now, of course, with perfect reconstruction. So you're actually not getting rid of any information at all, okay? And so the question is, and this is what I want to do now, is to tell you a little bit of intuition for, you know, why did we even try these crazy autoencoders where you have like a higher dimensional latent space than the original space. Okay, and this is just to show you, you know, here we just did it. I showed it for you for two cell types. This is just for all different cell types, and you sort of see exactly the same kind of pattern. Okay, so let's go a little bit into theory of like why, you know, why are we even, why did we ever try to look at these overparameterized autoencoders? And I should say now, for all applications, we're actually using overparameterized autoencoders. Okay, so let's go a little bit into it and give you some intuition for it. So this is just a standard setting. So we'll have our N training examples. They're living in RK. And now in the overparameterized setting, so you can either just have the latent space be larger dimensional than the dimension, or here I will just have like the number of samples be smaller than the input dimension that I'm taking. Doesn't matter in which direction you're going. And so here we're training our autoencoder, right, using these N training examples. So we're just trying to minimize reconstruction here. Okay, so what do we want to do? So let's actually look at this problem. So we're in the overparameterized setting. Let's actually just get a little bit of intuition for what is happening. So let's just do the linear case first. So in general, right, this is the map of the autoencoder, so this would be highly nonlinear. But let's just do the linear setting first, and let me just have one training example. That's the most stringent part, right? So then I would just try to do the following. So I'm trying to do argmin over, you know, A is in R of K times K, right? And X is just a one-dimensional vector, right? This is in RK. So I'm definitely overparameterized, and I'm just trying to minimize this thing here. So I have so many parameters, right? So first of all, you notice that there are many different solutions to this problem, right? So one solution is definitely, yeah, so definitely I can get this loss down to zero, right? And in fact, I can get it down to zero in many different ways. So one solution is the identity, right? So A is equal to the identity is definitely a solution. But note that there are many other solutions, right? In particular, there is a solution of any rank. So for example, there is a rank one solution, which would just project everything onto X, but you know, you have like any of the ranks of solutions here to this problem. So then the question is, what does actually an autoencoder learn? And so now this result, actually just for the linear setting, is very well known. In fact, it is, if you just do gradient descent started, and you know, in your autoencoders, usually what you do is you start with very small initialization. So in fact, if you start at zero, it is known that here what you would learn is in fact the rank one solution. So just a projection onto X itself. Okay, and now you can actually generalize this, and this will be the theorem in the end in terms of like what is being learned. But what we'll do just to get some intuition is, well, let's like actually just look at what happens when you apply a unit autoencoder when you train it just with one training example. Okay, so here is one training example, these nice bunnies here. You train it on these bunnies, and then you put in some random test examples. And well, let's see what comes out, right, when you feed it through your autoencoder. And what you see here, what happens is that always the bunnies come out. Okay. So I would like you to notice that this is stronger than what we saw before in the linear setting, right, where a rank one solution comes out. If it's a rank one solution, you wouldn't expect just the bunnies to come out, but you could also get, for example, the negative of the bunnies come out. So this here is actually a point map, right? It seems like it has learned a point map where it maps anything you put in to exactly the bunnies, and not like a linear combination of the bunnies. So many people would say this is not surprising at all, but I do want to just make sure that you understand that it is really surprising. So first of all, if you actually use, so UNet is really quite deep as well. So if you use a very shallow network, in fact, you will not learn a point map. Okay, so this is important to notice. So here, in fact, you're again training on one training example, you put in some random examples, and you see that outcomes actually something that looks very similar to what you put in. Now, again, there are papers that say you're learning the identity map. I'm going to show you this is not the identity map, and it will be really important to notice that this is not the identity map. Okay, but that will come on the next slide. But this is just to show that that you should be surprised by the result. Also, again, as I said before, you know, if you actually, and this is easy to prove, the linear setting. So if you use a linear autoencoder and you train it, say, on two examples, just to show you that, you know, this is, you know, in one example, you can actually get the negative of the dog or something if you train it on that. But if you do here a linear, then it's very clear that what comes out is always a linear combination of your training examples. Okay? And so in the linear setting, you should also expect to see the negative of your example that you're putting in. Okay, so here you get linear combinations. Here you actually get something that looks more like the identity map. So you should be surprised by this kind of result where, you know, if you have a quite deep network, in fact, if you just train it on one example, then it seems like what it is learning is the point. Okay, so then let me give some intuition for actually the map that is being learned. And this really comes from this shallow example. Okay, so, and the intuition is like really, really simple in terms of, you know, what we're doing in order to then show what we're actually going to prove. Well, an autoencoder is just so nice, right, that it maps an image to an image. Well, so if I want to say or understand a bit about what is the map that the autoencoder has learned, well, then let me just iterate the map. Okay, so if you're in this setting here, right, I put in this horse here and I get out something that looks very similar to it. But I'm telling you, it's not the identity map, because what I'm going to do is put in this horse again. Okay, whatever you got out, you put it in again, you put it in again. And in fact, you'll see that what will come out are actually the rabbits. Okay, and that's what we're going to prove. Okay, so, and here you see it actually, even if you train it on not just one training example, but you train it, in this case, we trained it on 500 training examples. And you know, these are all training examples, but then you just add a whole lot of noise on top of it, and you just put in this example into your autoencoder. And you know, this is already after a couple of iterations. So at the beginning, you get something that looks very similar to whatever you put in, and you iterated, and you see that in fact your training example comes out. So what does this suggest? Well, it suggests that your autoencoder learns a map where all of the training examples are fixed points. Or at least some of them are fixed points. And so you'll see, I mean, I'll show you, so you can prove which ones are fixed points. And so I'll show you on the next slide that we can actually train these autoencoders to make all of our training examples be fixed points. And the question is, of course, how large is the region of attraction, right, around every one of your training examples? And, you know, that's a good question. So here, for example, you have some just examples, right? So here, what we're showing you is that even if you take away, like you just add half of the image, just be noise, you know, in 421 of the examples, you're still inside the region of contraction around your training example. You're actually outputting the correct training example and not a wrong training example. So these regions seem to be quite large. This is, to us, an important research question that we don't have an answer to. How these regions of attraction actually look like. Here, we're just showing you a very simple example in 2D, where, you know, we just gridded the space and looked at where are we converging to. And this is, you know, how these regions look like. And this will depend very much on the non-linearity you're using. And so this will be one of the open questions that I'll have in the end. I mean, this is super important to understand, right, in order to use autoencoders in different kinds of applications where you may want to have these regions of attraction be slightly different. And this will really depend on the non-linearity that you're using. Okay, so as I said, so what you can actually do is, so what we cannot prove is that we don't have any other attractors in this whole landscape, other than, you know, just gridding it and seeing that we're always converging to one of the training examples. What we can prove when you train your network is whether every training example is an attractor, because you just look at, you know, the eigenvalues, right, at your training examples, and then you see that they're all smaller than one, so that you are an attractor at the training example. So here is a network, which is actually quite small, where we trained it, and we can prove that, you know, this network actually has all 500 training examples, in this case from ImageNet, actually as attractors. Okay, so you don't need very big networks to make all of your training examples be attractors. Okay, so what can we actually prove about all of this? So, and this is what we have. So for now, we only have it for one training example. And this is the following result. So, you know, you have your autoencoder of depth D and width K. So now here we have something called under suitable conditions. So actually all of the non-linearities that are standardly used will satisfy these conditions. Initialization has to be close enough to zero. And then what happens when you give me a non-linearity and initialization, then what this theorem gives you is a formula for the maximum eigenvalue of the Jacobian. So you know that the training example will be a fixed point, an attractive fixed point, if this eigenvalue is smaller than one. Okay, so from this formula, what you can then figure out is what kind of depth and what kind of width do you need in order to make this training example be an attractive. And so all this says is, you know, if you're overparametrized enough in terms of depth and width, then in fact, this training example will become an attractor for whatever non-linearity and initialization we're giving.
Caroline, this is like the phenomenon that you're describing is like a particular to overparametrized autoencoders or like any kind of autoencoder?
No, this is in fact very particular to overparametrized autoencoders. Yep. And in fact, when you're also applying them, you will see it. That in fact, if you have your underparameterized ones, in general, you'll not converge to a training example. You'll just converge. You can even converge to something like completely that doesn't look like an image at all, and you can converge to stuff that looks kind of like an image.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So it's like you are like factoring the identity map in many steps or something like that.
I mean. Yeah. So let me actually show you how I'm thinking about it in terms of the maps that are learned exactly. So yes, so first of all, and these are like the kinds of pictures. So in some sense, okay, so we all know, right, deep overparameterized neural networks, they can interpolate training data. But I just want to, you know, many papers use interpolation and memorization as the same thing. So I want to make a difference between the two because to me they're not the same. So interpolation, right, just means that I'm learning some function where, you know, a example will be mapped to itself, right? The training example will be mapped to itself, so you have zero loss. Okay, so there are many different maps, right, that can interpolate training data. So I can have this crazy map over here. So this is an autoencoder that goes from R1, how you should read this, to R1. Okay. And so say this is my training example, this is a training example, this is a training example. So this kind of crazy map is an interpolating map. Every training example is exactly mapped to itself. Now this map here in the middle is also an interpolating solution. And this one here is also an interpolating solution. Now, what this map here is the map that you have basically seen at the beginning, where we use the units on one training example, even if you use it on two or three. What you'll see is that it maps, this is the point map, right? Where, you know, all of these test examples in this case here would be mapped to this example. And all of these fellows here will be mapped to this one. So this is the point map, right? Where you just exactly immediately map out the training example itself. And then what we've seen on the previous slide is when you have very deep networks, this is what is happening. When you don't have that deep networks, but still over-parameterized, like quite wide networks, then what is happening is this following map here, right? Where, you know, if you iterate the map many times, then this comes up, right? But for now, the map that is actually learned is just a map that is contractive at each one of the training examples. So it is contractive at each one of the training examples. And once you iterate, well, if you just iterate this map here, in fact, this map over here will come up.
Sorry, is it all right to ask a clarifying question?
Please. Yes.
Why is it important to have these attractive training points?
Why would I want to have such a map? I think that's a great question. So here there has actually been, and so you were asking questions about even, you know, is this important for generalization? And then I'll have to also talk about why what is even generalization and for autoencoders. So what is kind of nice and why we didn't really have to, so first of all, it works in our application. Okay, so that's maybe one way of saying like why I actually care about these over-parameterized autoencoders. The other thing is that there has actually been work before where they wanted to make autoencoders be attractive at the training examples, thinking that this is actually a good property, where they added regularizers to make the map attractive at the training examples. So people have already used these kinds of maps with the additional regularizer, seen that these autoencoders actually work very well in practice. And so what we're showing here is that you actually don't need any regularizers. Like just overparameterization by itself will give you this property of it being attractive at the training examples.
Okay.
So,
so this being attractive at the training examples somehow makes the autoencoder work better in some way.
In many different applications, yes.
Okay. Exactly.
So we've seen it in our drug example. Others have just added regularizers to actually have this property and have then seen that these work actually quite well. And so work quite well. So then now we have to talk about generalization. I mean, there is no such thing as like, you know, what does it even mean to generalize well for an autoencoder, right? So this is another question that I think is an important one where there should be much more, also a bit more foundational work, right? So now people use it in the sense that like, oh, an autoencoder generalizes well if it learns something close to identity map. But I mean, I don't agree with that definition at all, right? If you want the identity map, you don't have to train. I mean, if this is what you want, then just don't train. So that cannot be the right definition of generalization. But maybe, and here I'm just proposing something that could be something, but you know, we have not done work on it, but you know, maybe a kind of definition that might make sense is that you should be close to the identity map, but at the same time, be contractive at your training examples. So that might be an alternative, and at least you have to train. And then, you know, what would happen is that these overparameterized, in particular, very wide networks will actually do very well if that's your definition of generalization. But I think there should be a lot more, you know, kind of more foundational work on what it actually means to generalize well for autoencoders. And certainly not, it shouldn't be that, you know, you want to learn the identity map.
Okay, sorry, just one last clarifying question. Could you please recap the intuition of like why having training examples as attractive points make it work well in your drug example?
Oh yeah, so I haven't even talked about that yet.
Oh, okay.
So for us, so the intuition, and so I think by now we kind of have a proof for what is actually happening, but the intuition at that point was like, okay, so here what we, and this work came before our drug example. So this work was there and then we built on it and tried to use it for the drugs. So the intuition was like, well, here what you're seeing is that you're going to become contractive at these zero dimensional points, right? So you're making points that are similar, more similar to the training examples,
right?
Right, because it's going to be attractive at them. So we were hoping that maybe this doesn't only hold for points, but it will actually also make lines, so one-dimensional things that are similar, and even manifolds, like low-dimensional manifolds that are similar to each other, more similar to each other.
Mm-hmm.
That was the intuition, okay? So that we make things that are, you know, already similar to each other, more similar to each other. And that's what seemed to be happening in at least the drug example.
Right.
That was the intuition.
Yeah.
Right. Let's use this over-parameterized setting so that it makes things that are similar, more similar.
Right.
And that's kind of what you're seeing, right? When you see this, right? It's making something like this is your training example. It was already similar to this training example. So, you know, the application of this network will make things more similar to each other.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree that there is quite a bit of a step there. And this is like definitely the kind of work that we're really excited about doing now on the theoretical side. You know, why does this actually work?
Right.
But that was the intuition.
Thank you very much.
Yep. And generally, I think, you know, the intuition for why you would want something like this is like, you know, you want it to be contractive at the training examples because you do believe that, you know, your training examples are important examples, or hopefully, you know, they were not just like, you know, they are actually hopefully representative of whatever you're expecting to see otherwise. And hopefully if you have something close by, well, maybe you may want to make it a little bit more closer to whatever you have already seen before. So this kinds of maps are self-regularizing. So this was at least at some point the intuition, and this was work by Joshua Benjo on, you know, why they had actually introduced these regularizers to make their autoencoders more contractive. Mm-hmm. But here, what this says is you don't need any regularizers. You'll just actually get your contractive maps just overparameterized. Just make your latent space large enough so that you're actually going to see this.
Cool.
Thank you for great questions. Good. Okay. So this is, as I said, this is the only proof we have. So one training example. So now everything will be, and this kind of goes into like the intuition for what we're doing now in the lab in all of our applications is always very wide networks and not very deep networks. And so the intuition somehow already came from here, right? You have seen it that when you're very deep, what you actually get is these maps that directly you map you to a training example. That's probably not what you want, right? You probably don't want that whatever test example you've put in, like a training example comes out. You probably want something that is kind of close to the identity, right? But still attractive at your training examples. And it seems like very wide networks and just a little bit of depth is actually doing that. And so here is the intuition for it. And we don't have a proof, but it would be really nice to actually have a proof for these kinds of things. So here you actually see these eigenvalues, and this is the top eigenvalue and how it changes when you're changing depth and width. So here what you see is with increasing width, and this is maybe difficult, so that's why we have like two different plots, one which, you know, you look at the top whatever percent of eigenvalues, and here you only look at the top one. But in all of our simulations, and this again, this is just a conjecture, it seems that what happens with width is that the variance of your eigenvalues shrinks, okay? And what happens with depth seems like what it's that the distribution just shifts towards, become smaller and smaller. So what you would want, right? If you want to be close to the identity and still contractive, what you want is that all of your eigenvalues are just below one, but not too small, because otherwise you're in this setting, right? If they're all below, like very close to zero, then you just have your point map. So that's not what you want, right? So that means that what you want is to be very, very wide so that you have a very small variance, and then just deep enough so that your eigenvalues are just below one, so that it is contractive at the training. So that's at least the intuition of like how we're using these autoencoders right now in all of our applications. But there is a lot to prove here. And now comes the Strudwick example, and I already gave you the intuition for why we have used it. And, you know, we've here just seen that it works well. And of course, there is a lot to do in terms of proving that, you know, this is in fact the right intuition of like, you know, why does it make also similar things more similar to each other, even if it's not just a point. But that was at least the intuition for us to try to use this here. Now, how do we use it? Now that we have these overparameterized autoencoders, I actually want to also show you how you use it in this drug example. So this is a standard approach of like how people, you know, do it. Computational drug discovery is often using this kind of signature matching approach. So here what we have is, you know, this is again data that, you know, came out after SARS-CoV-2 started, right? You have like your gene expression in the normal state. So these lung epithelial cells in the normal state. And then this is what happens when you add the virus. Okay, so this is the disease state. And so this vector here, and you see this is, you know, double the virus and ACE2 and whatever, you know, many different kinds of, just to see that this is kind of robust. So this direction always seems to be very similar, and this is the disease direction. Okay, so this is the effect of adding the virus does, you know, this to your gene expression. So now this disease signature matching, what it does is it tries to find a drug that, you know, its effect is upwards. Okay, so that, you know, hopefully, you know, you can just get rid of the effect of the disease by adding a drug that moves you back to the normal state. Okay, so now what you want is to find the drug, right? So now we'll actually map out all of the effects of the drugs in our latent space, which now is more aligned than what we had before. And then in there, now we look at which ones of the drugs is most anti-correlated with the effect of the disease and just choose those top drugs. that you get out there. And in fact, if you look at these top drugs, which is really nice, is that in fact, they're all in two different classes of drugs. So, you know, you don't get just like some completely random list of drugs. You get like actually two different classes of drugs. They're all very nicely consistent. And so, you know, whatever just a list of drugs is. So the thing is that many, and this is where, you know, we also wanted to look at, so these drugs have, you know, there are some known targets of these drugs, and these are all actually quite a lot of cancer drugs, which have a lot of targets. So what we wanted to do is not just have one of these cancer drugs that have a lot of targets, but also validate or try to predict what is actually the causal target among, you know, all of these list of targets that these cancer drugs actually have. So here you have a list of all these genes, right, that are targeted by these cancer drugs. And we just wanted to know among all of these, which one would be the putative one that we think is the causal one among all of these. Because then maybe, you know, you could use a drug that is more specific to that particular target and doesn't have as many side effects as these drugs that were found here, which are all these causal, which are all these cancer drugs. And so now this is where we used our, you know, previous all of this, you know, causal structure learning algorithms to figure out which ones of all of these targets would be the one that we hypothesize is the causal one. So what do we do here? So again, what we're trying to learn now is to try to actually learn these causal graphs. And so we just learn the causal graph. So you take out all of the genes that are differentially expressed in the disease, right? And among all of these targets, and you also learn the graph with all of these targets here. And what you expect, what would be a good target is in fact a node that is upstream to most of the disease genes, right? So you want to target something that is most upstream to all of the genes that are changing in the disease. That's a good target. And so what we're looking for is which one among all of these genes that are targeted by these drugs is upstream of most of the disease-associated genes. Okay, so we just learn these graphs and just we have a score for each one of the targets from the previous slide. And what comes out to be the most upstream is this RIPK1. I knew nothing about RIPK1 before starting this, but it's actually a super, super interesting protein. In fact, it's very stable, so you can do this in different kinds of cancer. So this is a cell line that is also in the CMAP dataset. If you do it in the ones that are actually in our body, these 82 cells, you get out exactly the same RIPK1 protein that is most upstream. And what is really interesting is actually, and this again wasn't put into our model, RIPK1 directly binds to SARS-CoV-2 proteins. And in fact, it targets RIPK1 very specifically, just entered phase 2 trials, which was like quite nice as well. So RIPK1 is a super interesting protein. You know, it also has it can have very different effects. And this is what we have also looked at quite a bit, because in aged individuals, SARS-CoV-2 has a very different effect than in young individuals. It can actually turn on two different pathways. And we think that this might be, or hypothesize that this might be going on in aged individuals versus young individuals. In young individuals, it might actually be turning on, you know, the immune response pathways, survival pathways, but it can actually also turn on other pathways, which are the fibrosis, like, you know, the death pathways, which actually lead to fibrosis, blood clotting, et cetera. Exactly the kinds of two different outcomes that you also see in patients. So this is quite an interesting protein that came out. Of course, a lot of things that need to be validated, but at least there is a hypothesized mechanism as well of how this could work. Okay, so I am kind of at the end, so 5:20. So this is just an overview that, you know, we looked at one causal question, which is how to predict the effect of interventions, right, of, in this case, drugs, and move over. So there are all these transport problems in biology that I find really exciting. So you have like this transport problem of like you have some drugs that you have observed in some cell types, and you want to predict the effect of these drugs in another cell type. I mean, the more extreme case would be, right, I have these drugs that I have observed in mouse, and I would really love to know what these drugs actually do in humans. Of course, we for now did this just for cell types, and I think that's maybe the more reasonable thing to do. But then you have also much harder problems, which is, you know, I have some drugs that I applied in one cell type. Now I would like to be able to transport to a new drug. Okay, so I have these drugs applied in one cell type. Now I have a new drug, and I would like to be able to predict what happens when you apply this new drug that you have never seen. Right? Before, we had already seen the drug and we just wanted to apply it to a different cell type where we also have some data. But here you have now a new drug and you would like to transport to it. Or, you know, you can have all these other transport problems that are maybe less causal, but you want to be able to transport between very different data modalities in biology or between different time points, right? So something that has always kind of bothered me when we're thinking about, say, early cancer detection is that, you know, if I'm training on data from a pathologist, I'll never be able to detect cancer earlier than the pathologist, because I'm always using the training data from the pathologist. So I need a way to somehow generate data, right, that corresponds to earlier time points. So how can I move between different time points? So generate my own training data of how these cells would have looked like at earlier time points. So I guess these are other transfer problems. And you see that, you know, there is a whole lot of nice machine learning kinds of questions and all these transfer problems in biology. So with that, let me end. So some conclusions. So, you know, I think, you know, drug discovery requires quite a lot more, more theoretical kinds of frameworks to look at things. In particular, I think causality is an important framework in drug discovery, because drugs are interventions in the system. And this is the only way to be able to predict the effect of an intervention if you actually take a causal approach. Autoencoders are not only extremely useful in biology, which, you know, my lab has used them a lot, but I think also really useful for studying just theoretical properties of neural networks. Here, you know, that they're actually learning these contractive maps. We're only able to see it because, you know, autoencoders are so nice that you can just reapply the map, right? It is hard to think of like how this would generalize or to, you know, to give you insights about the classification setting. I think that is a really nice question here. I showed all of these results on overparameterization, that they show these remarkable self-regularization properties. They learn these contractive map at training examples. Now, this is super important for, you know, if you're thinking about how could memory work, et cetera. So this is actually a new mechanism for associative memory. It's also, of course, it has negative, negative consequences as well. It probably means that you may not want to share a trained autoencoder between different hospitals, right? Because you can just put in noise and outcomes, your training example, and certainly means that you have a lot of privacy issues there. And a lot of open problems. I mean, causal transportability is one, right? Can you actually prove that, you know, you do get causal, you get, like, if you're overparameterized, you can actually do this, or you can sometimes and hopefully often do this causal transportability problem. Then I already said, like, classification, what does this tell us about classification networks? Would love to have a definition of generalization for autoencoders that makes sense and is not just, you know, learning the identity map. And, you know, I also already mentioned this, we have no idea, we do know from experiments that, you know, this attractor landscape is very dependent on the nonlinearity that you're using. It would be really important to figure out how this actually looks like and how could one optimize for different kinds of applications and nonlinearity that you're using. So with this, let me end. Acknowledgements. I wouldn't be able to do this without, like, really an amazing group of people, students, postdocs, and of course, collaborators. So G.V. Shivashankar on all of the biological work we have done, Misha Belkin on the overparameterized autoencoders work, and then of course, funding. And I'll end with just one slide of advertisement. I hope that's fine. That we just started the Eric and Wendy Schmidt Center at the Broad. If you like these kinds of problems at the intersection of machine learning and biology, I think there is a really exciting center going on. We have a lot of workshops if you're just interested in conferences, learning more about this intersection. And we're always looking for postdocs, etc. So with that, thank you very much. Okay. And happy to take any questions.
Thanks a lot. Caroline, I don't know, like, if there are questions, please feel free to ask. Otherwise, I do have a question regarding, like, you show, like, this coding space image in which, like, after iterating your autoencoder many times, like, different, like, inputs land into, I mean, you end up, like, dividing the space into regions. Like, I wonder, like, what is the relation with this method? With the perhaps, like, more naive, like, way of understanding coding, in which you have, like, these Voronoi regions and you assign, like, each point of the space. I mean, you partition the space according to how close they are to different centers.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what seems to happen when you have sigmoid nonlinearity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, so that would exactly be like a kind of conjecture, right? So when and under what kinds of nonlinearity or other architecture, you know, constraints, I don't know how much that will matter, but, like, you know, when will you get something that is just closeness? Right. So these pictures might be leading us into wrong kinds of directions, because these are just two-dimensional plots, right? What happens in this like highly over-parameterized setting, you know, is not so clear. So maybe it doesn't depend so much on the non-linearity anymore. Who knows, right? But that's exactly the kind of question, is like, when is there a non-linearity, or is it always the case that we'll just map you to the closest one, in and closeness in what norm?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And do you think like kind of like this different like behavior that you may have might like underlie like different notions of generalization?
I would think that probably for different kinds of applications, you may want to choose it in different ways. Also, you may want to have, I mean, what I think would be really nice is to have an example, right? Like, can you come up with an example that you will use as a training example that will just have a huge a huge basin of attraction, where somehow all of the nonsense will be matched to? That would be great, right? Can you just somehow come up with an example where all the nonsense, and for that you really need to understand this quite well, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I see. And regarding like the application to COVID or like pharmaceutical, do you think like what is like the current like a stage of like technological development there, and do you think like a pharma industry, to which extent they are interested in kind of applying this more like a futuristic like ways of understanding the problem?
Oh, they are super interested. Yeah, so we'll have joint postdocs. So yes, I think it's actually a really exciting time now, where pharma is actually really thinking about how to get into machine learning and how to use some of these, you know, methods where you have some theory, et cetera. And I think they're getting really excited about these things as well. So there are more and more pharma industry that are investing heavily into ML and actually have really good people. So I think it is exciting to work with them together if this is an area that, you know, you're excited about. Yeah, it's really nice to see. I think they do realize that, you know, something has to change, and that a lot of money is being put into things that in the end have not been super successful. So maybe this is a new approach, you know, worth investing into as well. So, yeah. No, I think it's a really exciting time for people in machine learning.
Cool.
Yeah.
So,
hi. Could I ask a question?
Please.
Hi, my name is Karen. I'm an oncologist. On the COVID slide with the drugs, I just wanted to make out two.
So you'll know all of them.
So in the list of drugs, there's a clear bias towards anti-angiogenesis drugs, like pazopanib, sunitinib, axitinib, that may warrant like further investigation. And been looking a lot, and just for my own curiosity, into the COVID literature, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's also like monoclonal antibodies against anti-angiogenesis, which would also have an immunomodulatory role. And in the PCA graph, the estradiol, although it's
So this one is actually in the original space, so this one was not in the latent space then. So this one was, that's why I was so surprised. I mean, I actually thought maybe like the people who came up with chloroquine actually just did the simple analysis, but then people tell me, no, this is already too advanced. They didn't do something like this, because here actually chloroquine among all of the drugs, among all of the list in CMAP actually came out to be the most anti-correlated in the original space with the disease vector,
okay.
Which I found amazing, because in the latent space is not the case. But they said this is probably not what people have done when they came up with this.
Did anyone look at the estradiol? Because COVID's supposed to affect men more than women in terms of severe symptoms.
We could check where this one happens to be, but I mean, it's not one of the top ones. So this would be interesting. So I would have to check where this one actually comes out to be in the latent space and how well it is correlated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for the fantastic
thanks
talk.
For the question.
Yeah, so since there are no more questions, but thanks a lot, Caroline. This has been very interesting.
Yeah, thank you all. This was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Great. So to everyone, a great summer. Mm-hmm. Enjoy.
Great summer to you too. Bye.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.